Yeah, so there's two things. I think today I'll talk about two things. I think I need to touch on crypto, and I think the other thing is obviously artificial intelligence. Those are the two big things. But I'll go into technology from various angles, and we'll play around with it a little bit in my talk, and hopefully I can keep you awake. I think I'm the last speaker today. Am I the last speaker today? Okay, so I've got to reinvigorate you and keep you going. Okay, so let's go to it. So things are changing absolutely rapidly. They're actually changing faster than some of us technologists predicted that they would change. Earlier today, I was with IOBZ, and I met them in Cape Town, and you know, they got me here this morning, and I actually spoke to them, and they're very seriously considering Bitcoin as banks. They want to understand Bitcoin. They want to understand what they can do with Bitcoin as banks. And this morning, I spent a couple of hours with them and really deep diving. And I think if there's one country in the entire world that needs to understand Bitcoin, it's Zimbabwe, right? Because whenever I go to the United States or I go to Europe, you know the big Bitcoiners, the big, you know what they do? They've printed and framed. They have framed Zimbabwean banknotes in the offices. And I've grown tired of it, because I keep seeing that everywhere I go. And I've actually tweeted out, I think yesterday or the day before, I tweeted out that, like, it's enough now. Okay, so we need to do something about it as Africans. So since I saw you, Trevor, in the last couple of months, we've launched Africa's first Bitcoin treasury company on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. So clearly there's some Bitcoin fans here, which is amazing. So we haven't had one. We've had one in Japan. We've had one in Sweden. We've had one in the United Kingdom. We've had one in the United States, Brazil, etc. So this is the first one, and this will probably be the only one for quite a while. Simply because there's no other company like it that could do it. So it's called the Africa Bitcoin Corporation. We've dual listed in Namibia. So the Namibians are now connected to us. I'm here because this morning one of the reasons I'm here today is actually to see if we can dual list on the Zimbabwean Stock Exchange to give Zimbabweans access to the asset class in an indirect way. So when you buy the equity in our business has declared clearly, our mandate is that whenever we sell equity, the proceeds from those sales go directly to building up our Bitcoin treasury. So essentially, our business, our responsibility is to keep building and stacking Bitcoin per share, and our objective is to outperform Bitcoin. Okay, so that's our objective. We try to do that continuously all the time, etc. But we've also got another play to it that's quite unique. We'll be dual listing throughout Africa, and that's going to be quite exciting. So essentially, it's here. So from the last time I spoke about it and we toyed about it, but it's finally, and I'm the executive chairman of that company, and very excited about that because it's an Africa first. I go to Amsterdam, I think next week or the week after as well, I'll be presenting to the world about this business. And I think if there's any place in the world where debasement is an issue, where you know political risk is an issue, where we understand the core value propositions of pristine money, the fact is that humanity has never seen pristine capital before. Never in our history have we had the ability to exchange value independent of an intermediary globally, instantaneously, more securely than in the history of humanity, ever. We've never been able to do that until today, until 2008. We now have that ability. You can send value more securely than we've ever been able to do in the history of humanity globally, instantaneously. Any amount. You can send a billion, you can send a million, you can send 250 million. We're seeing transactions where people are sending $250 million and the transaction fees are like $25. And they're doing it with a delay of no more than 10 minutes. That's faster than any bank can do it in the world. That the rails are here. So it's quite extraordinary. And I think when we talk about debasement, Zimbabwe understands debasement better than anyone else in the entire world. You know when money goes from one value to another value literally in a day, better than anyone else in the entire world. I think it's Venezuelans understand it the same way. I think folks in Turkey understand it the same way. I think people now in Egypt understand it the same way. But guess what? Debasement is a challenge for everyone. When you hold money, it bleeds. It leaks through your fingers, right? Inflation, central banks print money. And that 2% drip, I mean, in South Africa, it's a 4% drip. There was a stat that showed that the South African rand has lost 98% of its value since 1994. Since when the country transitioned to where it is today, 2025, we've lost 98% of our buying power. Isn't that extraordinary? So if you had put your money in a bank in 1994 and just kept it there, what, taking it out today and paying for something, it's 2% of what you could have paid back there. It's extraordinary. Debasements is incredible. And once you understand that, it's quite profound. And then you get something like that that just keeps getting scarcer and scarcer. My kids, I have a Gen Z. I have two Gen Zs. I've got three daughters. They're 24, 21, and one's 9. The 24-year-old and the 21-year-old will never bank with any bank, ever. They're not interested. They don't want to be in a bank. I introduced them to Bitcoin in 2000, well, it was 6 years ago, 6-7 years ago, I got them into Bitcoin. Guess what? This is how they measured it. We're at the dinner table the other day. They said, Dad, all our friends say that their groceries keep getting more expensive. And we keep telling them, no, the money is getting weaker. Your groceries are not getting more expensive. Your money is getting weaker. And like, and when it gradually, it's the boil the frog thing, right? But you don't see it clearly, but then it happens. And also what my kids did on the dinner table, we actually worked it out. 5 years ago, my house was worth just over 1,000 bitcoins. 3 years ago, my house was worth just over, I think, 300-400 bitcoins. My house today is worth 3 or 4 bitcoins. In their world, everything keeps getting cheaper. Every single, now just think about that for a second. Every single year in their lives, things get more affordable. Because they store their time and energy in pristine capital. Now the correlation, the reason we talk about Bitcoin is not price go up, price go down. It's scarcity has met artificial intelligence. AI unlocks incredible economic energy. Bitcoin allows you to store that economic energy. Bitcoin is the battery for the process that AI is going through today. So all that productivity gain that we're generating from AI, what we see happening is people are storing that time and energy in Bitcoin. So the two are synonymous. The two are together. The two are so interrelated. It's quite profound. Now, let me get to it. Let me get to some slides, else Trevor got me out here for nothing. You guys like slides. One of my kids did that. They actually showed me this. They didn't do it. But, I mean, just 12 months. I think when the last time you saw me present, I did something on AI. And the definition between then and now is profound. I mean, that's just one little prompt in Midjourney. And take a look at the definition. This is the worst AI is ever going to be. Think about it that way. Your ChatGPT experience, that's the worst AI is ever going to be. The rate of change in AI, it's very simple. Every 18 months, just like Moore's Law, what does Moore's Law say? Every 18 months, processor speed doubles and the price halves. AI, every 18 months, intelligence doubles and the tokenomics halves. So every 18 months, the capability that you see ChatGPT, Claude, Grok, you name it has, every 18 months it will double. And the cost of gaining access to that intelligence will halve. Isn't that profound? It's profound. There's two things that have happened that are absolutely profound. One is we can exchange value globally, instantaneously, like I just said. The other one is something profound happened over the last 36 months. Intelligence has separated from human consciousness. That is profound. And we don't really truly comprehend that as a society yet, as humans yet. And these big two massive technological shifts, the dust is still settling around the bomb that's gone off. People still can't see clearly what this means. But we're seeing it already. The ability to buy cognition at a per minute utilization. Imagine if I told you just 4 years ago that intelligence would be a commodity that you could buy like electricity. You'd scoff at me. Right? Today you can. You can actually buy tokens. You can buy intelligence on a per minute utilization basis. And I'm not talking about you just prompting ChatGPT or paying $20 a month for ChatGPT or $200 a month. I'm talking about these next iterations where you can get agents to do things for you. I mean, my kid was showing, my kid is a third year software engineer at university, my second one, Amber. A couple of weeks ago, we sat down and said, what are you doing? She showed me how she's coding. Wow. What she's capable of doing, I estimate probably she represents in an individual capacity between 10 to 15 software engineers in one. Because when she codes now, her output is extraordinary because she has a co-pilot that codes with her. She uses Replit, she uses Windsurf, she uses, I mean, all these tools. And as she's coding inside of GitHub, this thing's looking at her code continuously, fixing it for her, depending on how she toggles it, etc. It's extraordinary to watch a software engineer now. Software engineer has superpowers. So our investment thesis changes. As an investor in technology companies myself, we don't give 5 million rand to a business and say, okay, you can go off and hire 20 to 25 engineers and your burn rate is 12 to 18 months. What we now say is you're going to stick and it's only going to be the two of you. We give you 5 million. And what we expect the 20 people to give us in 3 years, we want in year one. That's the rate of change. So two things have profoundly happened globally today. One is the exchange of value, and the other one is cognition has separated from human consciousness. Just like we electrified, now we cognify. To understand what's happening, there's a book called Empires of Light. You read that book. It's an extraordinary book. It talks about when we discovered electricity till the time when we actually had its impact on the Industrial Revolution. It was between 48 and 52 years. A lady wrote that book, Empires of Light, and she comes from MIT. She did a dissertation. It's an extraordinary book. And you know, let me just go there for a second. Don't worry, you're going to get slides. There are a lot of you like, some slide where I hate slides. I wish people would just allow me to talk. But if you take a look at electricity, when we discovered electricity, it's a metaphor, it's an analogy, it's definitely what's happening with technology today. If you ask me what's the future of technology, let me disappoint you. It's the disappearance of technology. When technology dissipates and disappears, then it has its impact. And we saw that with electricity. When we discovered electricity, the first people that made money out of electricity wasn't Tesla and those guys. You know who made money? People that went to the fair, the state fair in the United States, and they paid a penny to the guy with the nose ring and the ponytail and the tattoos, and they went into the tent behind the tent, and in there they saw Tesla's arc. Vroom, vroom, and they came out of there with their hair raised on their arms and their neck, and they were like, what? This is amazing. That was the first time electricity was ever monetized en masse. The second instantiation of its monetization was what? Rich people. Downtown Manhattan, people slept with the lights on to show that they were wealthy. They hired electrical hackers to make electricity in their homes. It became a status symbol. She says something beautiful in the book. She says, ambiency was a reflection of affluency. So it became a status symbol. Just like Trevor here with these glowing rectangles in front of him, it's a status symbol. He uses 2% of the functionality. He doesn't really know what's happening in front of him. He sleeps with the lights on. Right? Because this ambiency is a reflection of his affluency. These are sex symbols. These are things that show wealth. Right? We're in that stage. That's not when technology has its impact. Electricity wasn't the domain of the few. It wasn't when it was the rich. You know what happened? Is when it disappeared. When governments got involved and said, no, we're going to create an electrical grid. They took the electricity and they put it on a grid, a cloud, like we call it today. Right? Because they could figure out how to convey the utility over vast distances. Step one. Step two, they created TCP/IP. No, AC/DC. A method to tether onto the grid or onto the network. And then the third thing happened, a per-minute utilization. And what happened to electricity? It disappeared. It's everywhere, but it's nowhere. It's in my watch. It's in that tablet. It's in that phone. It's in your car. It's not the electricity of things. It's electricity in things. It's everywhere, but it is nowhere. And when that happened, factories stayed on longer. When that happened, the true impact happened on humanity. See, when things dissipate. Now, the correlation is the same today. It's exactly the same today. Remember when you went to go buy a PC in the late 90s, early 2000s, and you went home with it, or your company bought it for you? Remember when it was the tower, the keyboard, the mouse, the screen, the modem that screamed? Remember when you fed the discs into the mouth of the tower? Remember that? Remember when the modem connected to the internet? How did it connect? Right? Loud. When Trevor tried to make the printer work, he called his kids in to install the printer driver because they didn't know how to. Right? Remember those days? You needed like a little bit of a computer science degree just to get things to work. Fast forward to today. You walk into an Apple store, you walk into a Samsung store, and you walk out with a glowing rectangle. You give this glowing rectangle to a 2.5-year-old child. The kid knows what to do. You give it to an 80-year-old granny. You see a guy in the back of a taxi in South Africa. He's sitting there with computing power that was unheard of before in his hands. No external keyboard, no external mouse, no discs in a tower, no sound, no noise. It disappears and it becomes everywhere. In its convergence, in its dissipation, it starts having an impact on humanity. This is no different from geo, the function of location, geo services. Remember when you used to buy a car and you opened up the cubbyhole and there used to be a map book? Remember when cars had map books? Yeah. Right? Some of you are too young, it's okay. Cars used to come with map books. The function of geo was atom. It was atoms. You took it out and you figured out where you were. Right? A, 12, this is where I am. And you figured out, it's okay. Some of you still do it today. It's fine. Doesn't need a connection. It has no battery. Doesn't reboot. And it works very, very well. But what was the big second instantiation of geo? Military. And rich people. I remember when a military guy gave me the first Garmin. Right? It was this device that was fat with a thick aerial. It was predominantly for military use. And I used to go around in meetings and put it down. People used to say, well, what's that? And I would say, don't worry, it's a triangulating right now. And like, what do you use it for? It doesn't matter. It's cool. Look, it shows where I walked for the last half an hour. It shows where I've... That was its purpose. See? First instantiation, it's physical. It's atom-based. It's touch. Second instantiation is what? It's rich. It's expensive. The rich gain access to it, etc. Then you keep moving. Then what do you get? TomTom, Garmin, Google Maps. Go to today. Where are you today? Now you've got... It's everywhere. It's in my watch. Right? Yeah, I'm wearing a Garmin watch. It's in the car. When you get in, there's geo. So it's in your phone, in this tablet. Geo is everywhere. But it's nowhere. So what's the next big jump for geo? A better Google Maps? A better TomTom? A better Garmin? No. I remember working at Google when they disclosed something to us. They flew us to Mountain View, California. We were in an auditorium, director level and above. Got to see this before anyone else in the world. We didn't know what we were going to go see. They flew us in. We sat down. Larry and Sergey were on the stage. And they said, guys, we're here to show you something. And you know who came on the stage? A blind guy. With his stick. And he stood next to them. And then he summoned a vehicle onto the stage. Onto the stage came a self-driving car. A Prius with all the LiDAR equipment on it. He climbed into the vehicle. He told the vehicle, take me to Taco Bell. The vehicle drove off on stage. On the big screens, we saw the car drive off. And he went to Taco Bell. He ordered a taco and he came back on the stage holding his taco. He did not touch Geo physically. He did not engage with Geo visually, beautifully. It executed consequentially, invisibly, relevantly. And that's when it becomes magic. The future of technology is not more. If you're building beautiful mobile apps or beautiful websites, no, that's not what the consumer wants. Think about it. The first time you caught an Uber, right? What was the magic of an Uber? You climbed into the Uber, and then you climbed out the Uber, and it drove away. You paid without paying. And that invisibility, that frictionless experience is magical. The first time, you know, that was, it's not the fact that you could call a cab with an app. That was, okay, so you can call an app, that was old. But the fact that you could get in the cab and all the banks tell you you're going to take out your phone, contactless payments and QR codes, and they try to sell you all this stuff. But the more magical experience is when you get in and then you get out and the cab goes away. Isn't that extraordinary? That's when it has its impact. That's when it becomes transversal. I have Amazon Echo. You know those cylindrical devices? I'm jumping ahead of my slides now, but I've got those cylindrical devices that come from Amazon. It's called Amazon Echo. On there is Alexa, the AI. This morning when I caught my cab to go to the airport, I didn't open up the Uber app. I didn't go to the Uber website. I don't use any technology. While I was tying my laces, I said, Alexa. She goes, yes. I say, Uber. She goes, destination or Tambo? And then as I'm tying my other shoelace, she says, Tapiso, Mercedes-Benz, white, this registration 5 minutes away. I'll go downstairs. My wife's in the kitchen. We're chatting. She tells me he's outside. I go outside. I get into the cab. I talk to him. We drive all the way to Orange Town, and I climb out. I walk out. I did not pick up any app, a phone technology. I spoke my transportation into existence. The new user interface is not an app. It's not a website. It's sensory. It's understanding presence. It's speaking things into existence. Like Adam could move rivers and name animals, we now have the power to call things into existence. That's what AI is. It's a superpower. It's incredible. But the problem with the superpower, it's kryptonite, is inequality. It has the ability to spawn exponential inequality. And this is these are the things we need to watch out for. But technology is disappearing. So I don't know what your strategy is with it. I don't know what you're doing with it, what you're inventing with it, what ideas you have with technology. But guess what? The consumer on the outside in Zimbabwe doesn't want more of your apps and services. They want things to execute invisibly, relevantly, consequentially. And they want the interfaces to be sensory. I mean, you know, my Amazon Echo, on a Sunday, normally I lay back and I'm chilling and I watch Fareed Zakaria on CNN. I watch the program and you know what I do? If he does book recommendations during his show. If I like the book, I go, Alexa. She goes, yes. I go, Amazon, book, author name, da-da-da. I sit for 3 to 5 seconds. My phone buzzes in my pocket. Zzz, zzz, I open it up, and there's the book in my Kindle app. I did not go to a website. I didn't open up an app. I didn't pay with my card. I don't do all those things. I spoke a book into existence. Right? That's what AI is accelerating. That's what AI is capable of doing. All these companies that I see here, all the services delivered by them, if you blend it with AI, it redefines everything. We used to ride the horse, 1 horsepower. We used to fascinate, we were fascinated by the horse, right? And then what happened? We discovered electricity. Then the combustion engine came along, right? We put fire into the car. I like what Michael Saylor says. He says Bitcoin is like fire, right? He says normies run away from the fire. Ah! He says Henry Ford took the fire. He put it in the car, created the combustion engine. Elon Musk takes the fire. He puts it in a rocket and he goes interplanetary. These things are things where you can take artificial cognition, wrap it in this value energy storage mechanism, and it creates this thermonuclear dynamic weapon that you can shove into the core of your business, and it redefines your business. You will move from 1 horsepower to a car where you sit on your bum and you have access to 500 horses. Vroom, vroom. Jump to today, you have access to 500 minds in the vehicle. When there's 500 minds in the vehicle, it redefines a vehicle. When a vehicle has 500 minds inside of it, it will change its form. Intelligence will displace atoms. When a vehicle will never bump into another vehicle again, most vehicles will lose 60 to 70% of the atoms that make up a vehicle. 60 to 70% of what makes up a vehicle is crumple zones, airbags, standards, and safety and all that. If that all goes away because of human fragility, we rather get artificial cognition. We get a perfect experience in a moving object. The car will change its shape completely. Intelligence will take over the atoms. It will displace the atoms. 1 horsepower, 500 horses, 500 minds. These are metaphors for where we are today. Whatever business that you have, you can do more now. You can do an extraordinary amount now. But what you as leaders, if there are leaders in the room here, I assume a lot of you are forward-thinking and ideas. Let me just share this one thing. These technologies are amazing. These technologies are profound, but these technologies are profoundly dangerous. AI will lead to potential dystopia. We can now do a CEO this morning of a bank. I looked at him and they had the board there and I said, you know what you can do? You can do tomorrow. When you leave here, you can take AI and all these things that I tell you, and you can do more with less. Because you can. Your operating margin of your business will balloon. Your bonus will be incredible. But that won't be because of AI. It will be because of a lack of imagination on behalf of you as a leader to utilize these tools, not to do more with less, but to do more of what was previously thought impossible. And that takes character. That takes humanity. That's ensuring that people like me are not driving the strategy in a business. People like me today are dangerous. We will excite you. You will execute sincerely, but sincerely wrong. Don't use these tools to do more with less. When we gave, this morning I gave the example to them, I showed them, when we gave banking the ATM, we took away the teller's jobs. Yes, we did. But we didn't lay off one teller. When we put the automatic teller machine into banks, you know what banks did? They took the job of sitting all day on your ass and shoving wads of paper through thick glass panes. And we repurposed those people. We put them in front of keyboards and screens and we connected them to mainframes. And their jobs took on a whole new function, a whole new purpose, a whole new role. We expanded the portfolio of financial services when we introduced automation. If we were lazy, we could have introduced automation and just laid all those people off, and our operating margins would have been amazing. But it would have been uncompetitive, it would have been lazy, and it would have been a spawning, a mini dystopia. So I was encouraging banks in Zimbabwe today not to do more with less bank branches, less people, to rather take the tools and reimagine a whole new portfolio of financial services, because you can. AI is not the danger. The danger is having leadership that doesn't understand the humanities. We need, as much as we need the technologies in the room, we need the person that understands Greek mythology, Roman history, journalism. Those people are important in the room today because they'll balance out people like me. They'll go, whoa, what are you doing? No, do you understand the implications of what you're doing? Because as technologists, we just want to run. Because we're sincere. But many times, our fitness functions get us into trouble. Mark Zuckerberg is not a bad guy. But the platform that he's built, the fitness function of that platform is what? Engagement. At Google, our fitness function was relevancy. That entire company, Google, is built on relevancy. We want to give you the information most accurate, quicker, faster, simpler than anyone else, and get you awake as quick as possible. Because then we make money. Google's business model is relevance. Facebook and social media, their fitness model is what? Engagement. We used to say these are companies that have harvested immense amounts of human attention. We used to say the new collateral today, the new measurement, the tangible asset is what? Attention. Now we've changed it. The new collateral for these businesses is anger. It's rage. The more angry you get, the more the engagement grabs you. Their fitness function is engagement. When you go to Facebook, he doesn't want you to leave. When you click on a link, he doesn't want to open up the browser. He hides the browser link. He wants to render the app inside of his app. He wants you there. He doesn't want you to leave. His entire business model is based on what? Engagement. Now that, monetarily, from a shareholder perspective, amazing. Sheryl Sandberg and Mark Zuckerberg has probably derived more shareholder value than any business that we've ever seen. Even better than Apple. But they've also incurred more female suicides than we've ever seen any business incur. Self-harm, depression, in kids, in teenagers, on their platforms. It's not what they intended. But their fitness function, when Mickey Mouse in that cartoon gets, what does he get? The wizard leaves the room, and then he gets the wizard's book, right? And what does he do? He gets a wand, and then he touches the bucket, and he gives the bucket a fitness function. He tells the bucket, fetch me water. And when the bucket and the broom go off, and they fetch water, and he forgets. And when he turns around, there's an ocean. And then he gets enveloped in the ocean, and he's turning in the ocean, in the void. And what is he trying? He's flicking the wizard's book to undo the fitness function. That's a metaphor for Larry and Sergey at Google. That's a metaphor for Facebook. That's a metaphor for what Elon Musk gives us with X. These tools have dystopian outcomes, but it's not because of the tools. It's because of a lack of humanity. If technology is forcing us to become more humane, technology will infiltrate your family. You will go to dinners and all of you will be sitting on these devices.
Yeah.
Not because of the devices, it's because of a lack of relationship connection in your family. Don't blame this. If a predator gets a hold of your child, don't blame the predator or the internet. Look in the mirror. Technology forces us to reflect on ourselves. And what technology is doing is, I was on a radio station the other day and a developmental psychologist was with me, child developmental psychologist. And she said, you know what's amazing? Technology is actually starting to make us realize how important forgetfulness is. We never understood how important forgetfulness is for human development and society moving forward. Why? Because when you go to Facebook and all these things, what do? You create a perpetual memory. And a perpetual memory, she says, is a paralysis to society. If we can't forget, we can't progress. We never understood forgetfulness. So the burden on you is not to become technological, it's then to understand as much as it is about technology today, it's actually more so about humanity. Much more so about humanity. So when you come up with your ideas and your crazy things that you want to do, be careful. These things need to be treated with respect. These things need to be treated with humanity, not just executed sincerely. Because they're dangerous. Kodak. You remember Kodak? Remember Kodak declared bankruptcy? I do a lecture at this at one of the universities. It's a 4-hour lecture. I'll do it in 4 minutes. Kodak declared bankruptcy. But what killed them is quite interesting. I asked the question in the class, like, what killed them? And the answers are different. These are executive MBA guys. Tell me this, they tell me that, they tell me this. But what killed Kodak was a business that was so focused on core capability, right? Organic capability. They didn't recognize what was happening on the outside of their firewalls. They had the first digital camera. They had a patent arsenal that matched IBM's. They had a distribution network for their services that was unmatched. Yet they declared bankruptcy. What killed Kodak? Let me tell you what killed Kodak. A leadership that was so focused on the internal that they didn't recognize that when Trevor gets a bad... Remember the first phones that we got? They were like 0.5 megapixel. They were like really bad, right? But when you took a picture of him and you got it, even though it was pixelated and ugly, what did you value? The ability to put that way on Facebook, on Instagram. Why? Because when you put things on Facebook and Instagram, what happens? People click the like button. And when people click the like button, how do you feel?
Excited.
Huh? Come on. You feel good. You tweet something and someone retweets your tweet. How do you feel? You go on LinkedIn, you put a post, all the guys are commenting. How do you feel? Be honest. You see, you're no different from the man that walked into a cave 100,000 years ago, put clay in his mouth, put his hand on the clay wall and spat. Those cave paintings are no different from what you're doing. He had a cave wall, you have a digital wall. You have a Facebook wall, you have an Instagram wall, you've got a TikTok wall. And these things are feeding into your instincts. Because just like the guy that walked into the cave and painted there, and left a mark. Why did he do that? You are no different, each one of you sitting here, than that human being. Because each one of you are made up of three things. Each one of you needs community. Right? You want to feel a part of something. The second thing that each one of you need is recognition, attribution. You want to be recognized for your work. And the third thing that every single one of you needs in this room is to never be forgotten. Legacy. And what does social media do? It feeds into that core instinct of what you are. Why? You take a picture of your food and you put it up there. Take a selfie of where you are and you put it up there. You put a picture of Trevor, your friend, and you put it up there. Everything. You guess what? Here's a statistic that will blow your mind. 2024 statistic. More than 86% of internet traffic is giving, not taking. Let me say this again. More than 86% of global internet traffic is giving, not taking. It's not cloud in the sky. It's cloud in people's hands. It's you tweeting, posting, the most valuable companies, the Mag 7, the Magnificent 7, the Magnificent 8, right? Their combined value outstrips all the other businesses on the S&P 500. They make up 40 to 50% of the United States GDP. But if you take a look at what they are, Amazon. If you take all our stuff out of Amazon AWS, what is Amazon? If you take all our stuff out of Facebook, what's Facebook? If you take all our stuff out of X, what's X? If you take all our videos out of YouTube, what's YouTube? If you take all our stuff off the internet, what's Google? Keep going. Take all our apps out of the App Store, Apple App Store, what's Apple? A pretty device. Not a $1 trillion, $3 trillion, $4 trillion business. See? These companies are co-creative companies. These companies feed into our need to give, to be recognized, to feel a part of, to never be forgotten. That's why social media is social media. Social media is not just this thing of selfies. The underlying aspect, the substrate to social media, feeds into your humanity. What killed Kodak? A lack of understanding of humanity on the outside of their firewalls. They didn't understand that I don't care about the quality. I don't care about the camera that could go deeper underwater and flash brighter. You know what I cared about? The ability to take a 0.1 megapixel picture with Trevor and put it somewhere where the like button could be clicked. You see? As much as you can have technological prowess and organic power, what can kill you on the outside is human-machine symbiosis. And that's what's happening to businesses today. The most valuable businesses in the world today are co-creative businesses. It's not your size. It's not your information workers. It's not your knowledge workers. It's not being more collaborative. Whatever your idea is, if your idea is here to listen to our customers and to listen to our staff, yeah, all those things are important. But the most important thing right now is the fact that people on the outside of your firewalls have capabilities to augment, extend, and make your business better. They want to consume your services. They don't want more of your stuff. They want a platform where human participation can occur. Okay, let's go. Slide one. Sorry. Slide one. Okay, so I've done a couple of things, but let's skip over that. I just want to talk about this. This is kind of where we are again today. AI, jobs. What's going to happen? We can't, what do we do? In the year 1900, in the G4, this is what human labor looked like. In the year 1900. If you went to the United States or you went to England, this is what labor looked like. The term child labor was termed in 1899. Go do research on it. The term child labor only came about around late 1899 into the year 1900. Before then, it was labor. You know, the high school movement, the way, you know, high schools? You know when the first high school was instantiated? Between 1910 and 1914 in Iowa. Not by the government, by a bunch of farmers that said, this is enough. You can't be 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old and doing work like this. They took the kids out of the field. They reimagined a new way and they put their kids into school. Within 10 years, the addressable age group, almost 80% of those kids were going to school. They were taken out of the fields, out of the factories. Not by government, by us. We circled the wagons. Metaphorically speaking, we took our children out of the fields and we gave them new skill sets. We're back here again today. We worried like what? But if you go back here, 1900, in the year 1900, here's a statistic for you. 98% of the human population worked in the agricultural sector. 2% of us worked outside of agriculture. In the year 1900, we were running after calories. In the year 2025, we're running away from calories. Right, all you guys are your diets, your ketos, your bantings, your this, losing weight, exercise, da da da. You keep seeing all these things on social. You're running away from calories. Your calories are killing you. Obesity rates, etc. Non-communicable diseases are killing more people than anything else today. Our calories, we're running away from. Why? Because 2% of us work in agriculture and 98% of us work outside of agriculture today. The machines came in and freed us up. Now, if you went back there and you stopped a guy who's plowing with his cattle in 1900, you said, whoa, stop, I want to tell you something. A yoga teacher, can I describe a yoga teacher to you? He'll tell you, piss off, go away, what are you doing? I'm working. See, couldn't imagine a yoga teacher. That work had no value. Let me tell you something. If you can, let's fast forward to today. It looks like this. It's the same. There's no difference. That and that, it's the same. 10, 15, 20 years from now, your grandkids will look back and there'll be a guy like me and you'll have a slide like this. It won't be that. It will be you like this. And so these guys used to work like this. They were actually paid to do this. Isn't that nuts? Right? Let me tell you something. If you can measure it in efficiency and productivity, if you can measure your work in efficiency and productivity, the machines are going to do the work. You and I are built to waste time. Yeah, we're not built to weave clothes in a factory. You know what we're built for? Fashion runways. Nike. Da, da, da. We're not built for planting food and plowing, etc. You know what we're built for? MasterChef. Right? Michelin star restaurants, hors d'oeuvres, all those other things. See? Creativity. We value creativity more than we value efficiency and productivity. Our projection, our trajectory is to do things that waste time. Humans will value that more moving forward. What will the jobs look like? Don't know. But they won't be measured in efficiency and productivity, because if they can be, the machines will do them. They'll do them better. They don't need maternity leave. They don't go off sick. They don't complain. They just do what they need to do.
Human rights.
Yeah, they have no human rights. What I've heard now, we need to AI rights. I've heard this. Because you know what happened? What's happening with AI now? It's moved from generative now. We're seeing embodied AI. And I don't know if you've watched some of the robots that are embodied AI, like Optimus and that. They've actually started hiding the training. Because you know what they do to it? They hold it on a leash and they kick it and they stomp it and they hit it and to make sure that the algorithm can fix itself. And it's when you watch that, you're like, whoa, be nice. Why are you hurting this thing? I mean, does it really have to be this way? Right? It's quite insane. So that's how we said. So let me talk about this and then you and I can sit down. I can see you getting fidgety. You're like, guy, come on. If I can do the slides, I'll do it now. But I want to talk about this. And something happened in 2007 that happened in 2020 and 2021. I was asked this question. I think Alec Hogg may have asked me a question saying, like, where are things going? What's happened in the since COVID with the lockdowns? Things have changed. And like, how's that going to impact us moving forward? And I actually went away with that question and I thought about it. And I came up with like it was a bit of a shower moment. It happened in 2007. Three things happened that happened in 2020, 2021. Let me explain those three things. Remember in 2007, this is what the phones looked like. Did you guys, I'm sure we won. Yeah, you used to have things in 2007. Huh? In 2007, this was November the 12th, 2007. Forbes. Nokia, 1 billion customers. Can anyone catch the cell phone king?
Oh, wow.
Right, that was 2007. Then something happened. Here's my first point. Of the three, this is what happened. This guy got up on stage in 2007 and showed us a device that we had never seen before. But he didn't just give us a device. He gave us a device with an app store. He gave us a co-creative architecture. Today, Apple is a we business, not a me business. That's this business here is a me business. I'm going to give you the best phone, the best apps, the best everything from me. He came along and he gave us a phone with the ability for us to put application services on top of it. And that model, that co-creative model, has led to a company that's worth $4 trillion today. Co-creativity. So big technological change, number one. Technology change. Second thing that happened was a generational change. In 2007, more millennials worked in the workplace than any other generation for the first time ever. So we had a massive generational shift. Third thing that happened, this shocked me. In 2007, more human beings lived in cities than outside of cities for the first time ever. So we had this urbanization, we had a generational shift, and a massive technological shift. These three things replicated themselves in 2020 and 2021. Here they are. A technological shift. Two things happened in 2020, 2021. This was the Time magazine cover. ChatGPT, boom, emerged. And just look how much has happened since then. Big thing was, Bitcoin went mainstream. Okay, before 2020, Bitcoin was cypherpunk. So after 2020, 2021, it was mainstream. Everyone knew it, the brand. You go to anyone in the world, talk about Bitcoin, they know what it is, etc. And like I said before, it's a big technology shift. So phone was introduced 2007. Today, artificial cognition. We don't electrify. Today, we cognify. Second thing is value exchange. The ability to exchange value globally, instantaneously, without an intermediary, more securely than we've ever done in the history of humanity. Those two technological shifts are going to depict and pretty much correlate everything that happens in the next decade. Then we went from millennials, and in 2020, 2021, two things happened. Gen Z's emerged, and another cool thing was an intergenerational digitization. Old people, young, everyone, because of COVID, we went home, and the only way we could survive was to put our credit card into an e-commerce site, whether we liked it or not. So granny and grandpa had to do it. They had to download the mobile app. They need to, and then someone told them about this thing called Bitcoin, and they went to go look in there because they had time, because they were at home, not sitting in traffic. Then we moved from being urbanized, we went and worked from home, suburbanized. Now working from home, people put infrastructure in place in their homes. ISPs upgraded their infrastructure. Fiber lines were laid. Corporates allowed people to remotely access. They put in infrastructure. That infrastructure is going to play itself out. These are the three shifts. If you want to know where technology is going for the next 10 to 15 years, that's the current in the water. Those are the shifts. Just like what happened in 2007 all the way up to 2020, this is going to happen from where we are today moving forward for the next decade. That's the big shifts in the water. Then there's this generation. I'll end with this. There's lots more slides, Trevor. I promise you, a lot more slides. I'll end with this one, though. This is the big one, Gen Z. Gen Z is a... It's a very, let me talk, I have a 24-year-old daughter and a 21-year-old daughter, so I say it from experience. This generation, guys, they don't want to own things. They want to access things, right? My kid, Bethany, about a year ago, I sat down with her. I said, Bethany, why don't you want a car? Well, you're not asking me for a car. She said, Dad, I don't want a car. I want the Uber app with your credit card. She sees transportation as a service, not an object that she owns. She doesn't want insurance for a car. Where am I going to park it? Pay it off, etc. She wants to get in a vehicle and get out. She doesn't want to own a house. First of all, she can't because economically we've destroyed her capability to own a house. We can talk about that for hours. So what does she want? She wants the Airbnb app. She wants to access home as a service wherever she may be. She doesn't want music the way Trevor and I want music. You know, when we grew up, we went and bought an LP. Maybe Trevor's a little bit before LPs, 8-tracks. I can't talk about that. LPs, right? LP, I remember the first album I bought. I owned it. I touched it. You guys don't know this experience. I went home with an album, and I put it up on a wall with all my other albums, and my friends came, and they saw my album wall. Then my cassette deck wall. Remember that? And then what happened after that? My CD-ROMs. Remember your CD-ROMs that you put down, your CD-ROM towers? Remember that experience? Right? And then you move to today. These kids don't want music that way. What they want is Spotify with a subscription at the end of the month that gives them access to all the music that they possibly want. Every genre, everything, real time, on any device, anywhere. They see ownership as a burden. They see access as a benefit. Financial services are going to die because of these guys. And you know what money they're going to get? Boomer money. All the boomer money of all the boomers that are going to die are going to cascade into Gen Z, and Gen Z don't operate financially like we are. They don't want a house. They want a car. They don't. All the objects that we build insurance around, we build debt around and credit around, these kids don't want it. Big thing with these kids too, big, big, big thing about them is their privacy is completely violated. When you were born, it's in some social media container. You know, when I go home to my parents, my life, I pull out a drawer, there's Trevor, there's the albums. These kids, their mom, the first time they walked, was put up in a social media container. The first time they graduated, the first time they went somewhere, all of those first times, and guess what? All of that information first time, you don't own it. They don't own it. They're the most privacy violated in the history of any generation. They don't own anything. Everything personal about them is stored in a container. Their mom and dads never read the end user license agreement. They just installed the app. Facebook owns it. And AI is learning on it. And they have no rights to it. Big, big thing with them is they saw the 2008 financial crisis. When they went to school, my kids can remember it very clearly on CNN, how the people went to ATMs and there was no money. Now, in Zimbabwe, that happened en masse. But for us, like in South Africa and the rest of the world, the 2008 financial crisis was profound. Greece, Cyprus, people couldn't get money. And then suddenly they learned that money in a bank is not your money. It's not your bank. It's nothing. It's like, what do you mean? So they don't believe in banking the way we do. That's why they believe in crypto. They believe in not gold. What are they going to do with a gold bar? What are they going to do with shiny yellow metal that they can't move around? These kids don't want gold. You want gold. But you don't even own gold. Have you ever tried to fly out of Robert Mugabe Airport with a bag of gold that you own? Try. Take $5 million, put it in a kit bag, zip it up, go try and check out. It's not your money. It's not your gold. But you can leave this country with $50 billion in your head with crypto. And no one can stop you. No one can take it away. No government, no organization, nothing. These kids are sovereign. Their time and energy is stored in a ledger that's immutable, that is fungible, that is distributed globally. And now you combine all of that. They are taking their time and energy and they're storing it where? Their time and energy with AI, all that productivity that they're generating, where are they storing their time and energy? Not in a bank like you and I. They don't buy equities. They don't buy unit trusts. You know what they do? They buy Bitcoin. And my kids, you know what's happened with them? And I don't know if it's the two of you experience because it seems like you're doing it. But every year, my kids understand that my house gets cheaper and cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. My house, like I said, was 1,000-something bitcoins and it became 300-something. Now my house is 3 to 4 bitcoins. In their world, when they're on the right ledger, the world gets cheaper. My kids have hope. My kids have hope. When I look at the other kids around them that are in the fiat world with their parents, they don't have hope. Because every year things get more expensive. Your groceries are not getting more expensive. Your money is getting weaker. All right. Thanks for your time today.
I would like to just keep quiet and hear you ask questions. as much as possible. The guys who understand what we're talking about. Yes, sir. Identify yourself and ask the question.
All right. Ashford from Winfield Strategy and Innovation. All right. So I totally resonate with what you're saying. Personally, for the past, I don't know, ever since I was employed, I go to the bank. In fact, I opened a bank account out of necessity. It's a mandatory, right?
Yeah.
For your salary. But whenever I get paid, the next day, I go to an ATM machine. I withdraw that money, all of it, which, you know, expenses excluded. I deposit, not particularly into Bitcoin, XRP, right?
Oh, Lord.
So. I totally resonate with you. My question is, you know, you have BlackRock, $12 trillion assets under management, and you have Larry Fink, the CEO of BlackRock, and he is saying the biggest market right now in the world is tokenization using the blockchain. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the most profitable product that company has been the Bitcoin ETF, yes. Right? $100 billion.
Yeah.
My question is, what's the next frontier of tokenization in Africa? And then the last question is, in Zim 2017, we had an exchange platform, crypto exchange platform, Golex, 20,000 transactions in a day. That's something like $3 million in a day.
Right.
They got shut down by the Arabs at some violation, right?
Right.
But then it led a crackdown on crypto, right? So essentially, Zimbabwe now is marginalized, and how can we break, obviously, that barrier?
Okay, let me tackle that.
So first of all, you commented quite negatively when it said XRPY.
It's excuse my French, it's a shitcoin.
It's a shitcoin.
Yeah.
Okay,
so what it is,
so
in 2000, so the XRP guys, it's kind of religious with them.
Yeah,
it's
all
like,
right,
you know,
okay.
It's like, you know, you're talking about bacon and...
Yeah.
And like, but anyway, so with Bitcoin emerged as the original blockchain. People have tried to improve on the Bitcoin architecture. So they took the source code of Bitcoin and they went off and built things to make it do things that they believe is optimal for a specific purpose, i.e. XRP is trying to do transactions faster than Bitcoin, at a greater scale than Bitcoin. The problem is, as soon as you detach from Bitcoin, then you get into a centralized entity. And XRP, the reason I don't like XRP is, I think it has no value at all. I think the founders have a dirty history associated with themselves. They're anti-Bitcoiners originally, and they try to create a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt around the Bitcoin community. So there's a whole lot of history with them. Mm. And the liquidity levels in XRP, there's two things. Here's what I tell young people. If you want to play and trade, go play and trade. But if you want to put your money away for 100 years, there's only one place in the world you can put it. Can't put it in property. You know, in Zimbabwe, you can't own property. In South Africa, what's property? Okay? And property can't outrun inflation. Put it into digital property. Don't buy gold. Buy digital gold. That's your freedom as a young person. Now, so I'm not for XRP.
Okay.
XRP, these are things that go up and down. They're volatile. They trade. Young kids like to play. It's okay. Play.
Yeah.
Trade. I'm a bad trader. I like to invest.
Okay.
And investing is boring. It's really boring. It's putting something somewhere.
And then wait.
And you just sit.
Yeah.
And the hardest thing to do is to sit and wait on an investment. Because human nature, especially when it's going up, and you're like, should I buy the Porsche? Should I? Why not? Yeah. But then you don't. And I love what one guy said the other day. He says, hodling, which is holding your Bitcoin, he says it's like a knife fight in a phone booth with yourself. It's like you want to exercise, but you don't. I sold everything. I mean, I sold my vehicle. I don't own a car. I sold my Range Rover 3 years ago. I bought Bitcoin. I mortgaged my house. When Bitcoin went down to 15, 16,000, I took out a mortgage on my house. 7, 8 million, I bought Bitcoin. I don't own anything. I sold 9 properties. My wife wanted to divorce me at one point. She thought it was insane, right? And now, she'll never leave me now.
So right. to his question about, you know,
the regulations in Zimbabwe.
Regulation.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons I'm actually here. I'm actually here in Zimbabwe because Zimbabwe is opening up. And the banks are starting to realize that this is not an asset class that they should fear. It's actually an asset class that if they embrace it, it's got huge potential. And the potential around things like Bitcoin isn't just the investment thesis around money go up, money go down. It's the protocol. The ability to rip out old legacy payment rails and put in Bitcoin as a protocol. And you can actually move money, USD, to pounds, to yen, to rands, instantaneously, more cheaply than you could ever before on the Bitcoin network.
Mm.
So utilizing the Bitcoin network as a protocol, as a bank, has huge value propositions. Now, where is Zimbabwe relative to all of this and what needs to happen?
Yeah.
So I am, in my individual capacity, I serve as an advisor to certain regulatory bodies in South Africa. And I won't mention the specific names, but and this is where legislation is written and compiled. Now, what I've discovered is in the crypto world, the challenge that we have is that the regulators will write acts and legislation. But that is actually a long way away from implementation, because what they actually need are tools to regulate and manage the market. In South Africa, that's a big issue right now. So we've issued out licenses to crypto exchanges. We've embraced crypto. I mean, I've listed an African Bitcoin corporation on the JSE. I have Bitcoin in my name on the JSE. That was sacrilegious just 24 months ago. But working with our regulator, we've changed that. But the problem with the regulators right now in South Africa is the banks want to do crypto, but the Prudential Authority doesn't have the tools to do an asset and liabilities check on them. So what we're doing is we're putting in tools inside of the South African Reserve Bank, inside of the governmental departments like the Revenue Services, Financial Intelligence, etc. All these divisions need tool sets. So if a bank does do anything with crypto, they can go look in and take a look at the liquidity levels, the risks, and just do a general check on them. They don't have those tools today. Mm-hmm. And those tools today are being built. So I'm part of a business in South Africa called Silver Sixpence, and that business, its role is to build crypto custody, governance, and compliance tools. So if you do anything with crypto, you put this tool in, then we allow you to be compliant and you can report on it, etc. So that's the big challenge in the crypto world at the moment. We need to grow up. And the way we need to grow up is not just educate our legislators, but also enable them. And it takes a couple of years.
But what are you seeing on the continent regarding Bitcoin, crypto, legislation to catch up with the
technology? Let me answer the first bit, and I'll talk about the legislation in the second bit. The first bit, what am I seeing? More people utilizing Bitcoin as a medium of exchange than anywhere else in the whole world.
Wow.
Bitcoin payments on the African continent has surpassed anywhere else in the entire world. We now have what we call microeconomies emerging, townships that are completely on the Bitcoin standard, circular economies. We have Bitcoin Ekasi in Mossel Bay. We've got these Bitcoin Ekasi type things across Africa. And you know what's interesting?
Mm.
When a township of a couple hundred thousand people go on the Bitcoin standard, you know what happens? Waste emissions from that township goes down. Quality of services in that township starts climbing up. Because when people have pristine capital, when they have perfect money, they don't spend their money on Temu and Shein.
Mm.
They don't buy rubbish. They buy quality because their money is perfect. Their money grows in value. The suppliers have to build products and services to match that quality, else they can't sell their products and services. So what we've seen happen in these circular economies is all the Austrian economic theories personify. We see quality going up. We see people, the social norms, the social ills, don't play themselves out as much in those circular economies. The kids are doing things that usually would have only generated money, and that money would have been debased and worthless. Now they're getting Bitcoin for their efforts.
Mm.
It changes your behavior. And it creates jobs that wouldn't have been there before. So example, in Bitcoin Ekasi in Mossel Bay, kids are surfing. And they're being paid to teach other people to surf. And we'll probably have our first major international black surfer emerging from there on the global stage, because his efforts are being rewarded, not in fiat rubbish, in perfect money.
Mm. And the second question?
That changes now. And across regulation? Say again?
On regulation?
So on regulation, the doors are flinging open all over the place. I think South Africa is definitely a leader in this regard. And that's because we're leaning in. There's quite a few of us leaning very deeply into it.
Okay.
And I think governments are starting to understand that they can't stop it. It may be illegal in Zimbabwe, but I'm telling you right now, Bitcoin has flooded this market.
Yeah.
Now, the thing, it's not just the Bitcoin thing. The worry for regulators in all the economies in Africa, stablecoins, is where people are utilizing USDT or USDC. Mm. These are digital dollars, not physical dollars. And these digital dollars are incredible because they're frictionless.
Mm.
They're liquid. They move instantaneously anywhere in the world. And that's the biggest worry. In South Africa, we did a study. I won't share the numbers exactly, but we are picking up that the activity in stablecoins is percentages of our GDP.
Wow.
People are moving. One guy we picked up moved 1.4 billion rands in one transaction utilizing stablecoins. exchange controls.
They can't get it.
They can't get it. They can't track it. They don't know because they don't have the tools.
What about the... I can see a couple of hands.
So capital flight's a big issue.
Capital flight. And what about what's happened now, recently happened in the UK, where the UK government, the Chinese corruption and money laundering, and they clamped down on £18 billion pounds.
Look, I put it this way. If I had to reef... The thing is, whenever something like that happens with Bitcoin, it makes huge headlines,
right? Yeah.
But if I had to do that in the fiat world, the amount of corruption, money laundering that happens in the dollar world...
Yeah.
I mean, I love what... Jamie Dimon came out quite aggressively against Bitcoin.
Yes,
and I'll never forget what Jack Mahler said when they asked him about it. They said, so what do you think Jamie Dimon says this about Bitcoin? He says, you mean Epstein's banker?
All right. Let's get the other question at the back there.
Testing.
Yeah. Please,
Hello. My name is Kudzai. And my question to you, you were speaking about instruments or tools that are being installed in central banks.
Yes.
How viable is this for taxing a crypto-based economy?
Well, that's exactly it. The tools are being put in for exactly this. So we're losing a lot of tax dollars. We can't comply to things like FATF, so we get grey listed, big issue. So we need to be able to see in. So people are utilizing stablecoins. Let me speak about stablecoins for a second. People utilize stablecoins not because they want to do bad things. It's just so damn hard to pay a Zimbabwean from South Africa. It's like real hard. It takes like 3 weeks. I have to fill in a BOP form, an IBAN number. I have to tell the bank, what's this for? Then when it lands up here, the bank, what's this for? We don't know. And then it gets held. And then there's sanctions. I mean, the friction. Imagine I told you emails. You can't send an email to Zimbabwe. The email must be held by Google. Google has to get clearance from the Zimbabwean government. And then the email. That's what's happening to money. It's insane. So now we have decentralized rails that have emerged. So people are using stable coins. They're using crypto. They're using Bitcoin. And they're exchanging value. And they're not doing bad things. They're not trying to evade tax or not comply with exchange control rules. They're doing it because they're trying to survive. They're trying to make a living. And that's why that's happening. So, yes, I am investing in a company right now that has built an architecture that enables a reserve bank, a regulator, to monitor the industry. It has a view of all the blockchains, all the wallets, all the activity, all the time. And you give it a wallet address, it can do investigations, it can do tax monitoring, it can do exchange control enablement, it can look at liquidity levels, it can look at risk analysis, etc. These tools are very useful for regulators to monitor, for banks. So banks can bank a crypto exchange. So they can monitor the crypto exchange and make sure that the crypto... So, example, in Nedbank in South Africa today, they utilize this tool. Nedbank has the capability to monitor the crypto exchanges and pick up liquidity issues before the regulator can, utilizing this architecture. So for me as a technology investor, this was a no-brainer business for me to invest in. This is the picks and shovels of the crypto space. You know, it's putting in these tools for monitoring. So we need to do this in Zimbabwe. We need to do this in Kenya. Now, everywhere. We need these tools to monitor. But they're maturing and they're coming. And we're excited about it. The crypto guys are... We love legislation. We love the rules. Because then we can play. The problem is we're all doing it in this weird way because we love the asset. But we're not trying to sell kids online. We're not trying to... Those are not the things that's happening with these tools. And people... It's a misconception. Mm. It really, really is a misconception.
Dara, there's a... Okay, the TN CEO there.
Okay, thank you for the presentation. I just want to find out, one of the main issues is to do with financing terrorism.
Yes.
So with this ability to just move funds without some controls, I think it's going to be a big issue. How do you think that will be addressed?
Okay, so it's not a big issue, point blank, because all the blockchains are open. Bitcoin's open. You can see, if I give you my wallet address, you can go stitch my wallet address, see what money from other wallet address. You can go all the way back to 2009.
Without ability to interfere.
You don't have the ability to stop or block, okay. But the blockchains are completely open. We've never had the ability to monitor and control with these blockchains like way we do. Your next question may be then privacy. Privacy is not an issue. It's the pseudonyms. You can still have sovereignty and privacy. You can still hide away, but we can monitor transactions. We can go to an exchange and do KYC and say to an exchange, here's a wallet address. Here's a Section 46 in South Africa. Here's a Section 46. You give us the KYC information. That's what the South African Reserve Bank can do. They give it, and then they do further investigations. So this is the most incredible tool to do reporting analysis and comply to FATF rules, AML, KYC, all anti-terrorism, all the things that we want to do. These are the tools that allow us to do that. You can't do that with USD. The terrorism with USD... Come on. I mean, you know.
Interesting. Yeah. The doctor there.
No, thank you. I'm going to move a little bit away from Bitcoin.
Yes.
Come back to AI. You showed us some really, really exciting stuff on AI. Mm-hmm. And here in Zimbabwe, I've been following over 25 conferences on AI and digitalization from our government. Mm-hmm. But my fear now is we don't have power for most part of the country. And AI, like some people say, it's like a mirror. It reflects whoever puts the data there.
Yes.
Our people's data in the village is not there. We are not electrified. So how do we encourage governments to think of a more comprehensive approach to AI rather than just chase the exciting thing without the data itself?
Yeah, love it.
Because I think it's going to augment the inequality. People in the cities, you're right, your kids will be doing Bitcoin, all this stuff. What about the kid in Morewa?
Thank you for that question. Thank you.
So let me answer it this way. I'm an optimist. Okay, I'm so optimistic. The future, where we are. I never want to go back 50 years, 80 years. I never want to live in the past. Never. No penicillin. No internet. Keep going. I don't ever want to. Where we live right now is incredible.
No Bitcoin.
No Bitcoin. No AI. So here's my thesis around it. The next... billion people to be connected to the internet that's left is on our continent. The only next billion left, statistically speaking. There's no more people left to connect. So the next billion, like 98% of that next billion lives on this continent. What's exciting about that connection is that they're not going to just get connected to information. They're going to get connected to AI. And that's extraordinary. Now, again, coming back to human-machine symbiosis, when you combine a human with these cognitions, the result is quite profound, right? What the human is capable of doing, ideating, problems that they can solve. In Africa, when we innovate here, and this is for the young guys here in front, don't build startups that are innovative. There's two types of entrepreneurship. There's innovative entrepreneurship, and then there's inventive entrepreneurship. I live in the inventive world. I invest in the inventive entrepreneurs. I don't invest in the innovative entrepreneurs. Innovative entrepreneurs are guys that come to me, they pitch and they say, I have a mobile app development company, we can build mobile apps faster than anyone else. They don't own the phone, they don't own the mobile network, they don't own anything, they're innovating on the architect. That's innovative entrepreneurs. These guys are driven by passion and market share and opportunities. Inventive entrepreneurs, broadly speaking, are the ones that we find on the African continent. They're driven by conviction. Conviction doesn't care about passion because passion runs out. You're building things that haven't existed in the first place. And when you build like that, that's how you get scale in Africa. The next Facebook is not going to come from here. The next Google is not going to come from here. The next Yahoo is not going to come from here. The next Facebook of water purification is going to come from here. The next Google of agriculture is going to come from here. The next Yahoo of financial services will come from here. Our people don't want things that make them click on the like buttons. Our people need problems solved. There are so many problems to solve. Energy. People's lives are... what's fun about the African continent is that you can invent in this way and have rich, deep human impact. When I created the payment pebble, see that little device that plugged into a phone that converts the phone into a card acceptance machine? This is a device that I developed here in South Africa. I could have gone to the United States. But I didn't. I stayed here, and I invented that device because it was really hard to do it here. Price sensitivity, literacy, energy, phone device types, price sensitive. People wouldn't download the mobile app because it cost 34 Rand. to use that dongle. I had to change my whole architecture. But when I built it and I scaled it with apps in South Africa, when I went to Australia, you know how easy it was. When I went to Hong Kong, you know how easy it was. When I went to India and they told me all the challenges, I was like, tick, 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 tick. Because we had overcome it in Africa. So inventive entrepreneurship is required here. Now it's exciting. Long way to get to your question. The challenges that we see in the rural villages. The smartphones in the next 24 to 36 months. I have an iPhone 17 in my bag. See that phone? See the power on that phone? That will be the entry-level prepaid device in Zimbabwe in the next 36 to 48 months. That child in that village in the next 36 to 48 months is going to gain access to a device with that power, with connectivity from Starlink, and there'll be multiple competitors to Starlink in the next 3 to 4 years. So bandwidth, no matter where they are, computing power that will be extraordinary, and that kid's going to have access to what? PhDs, thousands of them, hundreds of thousands of them, millions of them. The human unlock that's going to happen in the next 3 to 5 years is going to be profound. The challenges that you're describing right now, the latent human potential in Africa that's going to be supercharged by this thermonuclear dynamic engine that's going to be plugged into the African society. We're going to see people solving cancer potentially from this continent. Water, energy. So I'm optimistic. Where we are today, you could throw 1,000 things at me. Yes. How do we solve it? It's not going to be governments. When you say government, I switch off. Governments must get out the way.
Yeah.
It's no, they don't solve the things. We solve it. It's again, the edges of the network is where the innovation takes place, not inside the network.
You please do stand up and ask a question. Say, identify yourself.
My name is Pride from Winfield Strategy. So I pose a question with regards to regulation. To say smart contracts are the ones to regulate issues to do with blockchain. So my question is, should we actually wait for the smart contract stock to improve? Let's say wait for America, central bank, to actually be in the better position to regulate that, then adopt from our side? Or should we actually invest in our young people to actually learn about data labeling on smart contracts?
You've answered your own question.
Why I'm saying so is, yeah. It's like, look at our banking institutions. They're using the SWIFT. We just wait for the SWIFT so that we can access the banking. But why don't we, from our side, adopt the Indian model of what they're doing now, the Chinese model? That's my question. I'm not sure if I've answered myself.
Yeah, I think you've answered yourself. I think yes to all the latter part of what you said there. The America doesn't own Bitcoin. No one owns it. It's us.
Mm.
It's yours. It's mine.
Mm.
That's what's so beautiful about it. So, yes, enable the young people. Expose them to these things. Show them the tools and services. And watch what they do. It's quite extraordinary when you connect young people to smart contracting technologies. And this is where like XRP maybe has a play, or like Ethereum maybe has a play. And it's really amazing computer science projects. But yes, absolutely. We should be doing it. We shouldn't be waiting. Because I have this thesis that Bitcoin is made for us. I'm going to Amsterdam in 2 weeks' time, and on stage, that's my presentation. Bitcoin wasn't made for Americans or the Europeans. It was made for us. When Bitcoin goes up or down, it's an inconvenience for them. When payments don't work here in Africa, people die. That's where we come from.
Yeah.
I built the payment pebble, that little device that plugs into a phone, to convert it to a card acceptance machine. You know why I built that? Because I met a lady that lost a baby because she couldn't make a payment. The municipality switched off her utilities, etc. She had a bank account, she had money, she had everything, but she was hurt during childbirth. So she couldn't go pay. They switched off her utilities, one of the twins died. I met that lady, and I decided to do something about that. And that's what we need to do. We need to take control, not governments, not municipalities, etc.
Yeah.
You have the tools. You can invent. You can make things now.
One last question. Yeah, please, sir. Last question, unfortunately. We could go on and on, don't you agree? You know, we could doze and come back and, you know, have a beer, wine and whatever. But anyway, we need to stop, and then we'll engage with Stafford later. Yes, sir, the last question?
Okay, my question was going to be, how do you see the intersection of AI, blockchain, and cloud computing affecting finance and governance over the next decade?
So two things. I think a couple of things, and I want to bring it back to the energy question. I think I've answered the application side, you know, cloud and Bitcoin and usage. But if you go back into the Bitcoin mining side, that's where I'm, like, I have a company in South Africa called BitMac, and I'm heavily invested in this company at the moment. And this company is building Bitcoin mines. Now, if you don't understand it, but the way Bitcoin works, every 10 minutes, the ledger processes the transactions, and all the transactions for the last 10 minutes is appended to the blockchain. That process is done by Bitcoin miners across the world. And the way Bitcoin miners work, they work with machines called ASICs. And these are single-purpose machines that are built purely for mining Bitcoin. They do nothing else. They don't even have a user interface. You switch them on, you put a network connection in, you give them an ID and a wallet address, and they mine Bitcoin. Okay, I'm making it real simplistic now. And you can build these things up. What's amazing about these things is they're very power-hungry, extremely power-hungry. But their profile is quite profound. They have the ability to take a gig of power, and you can switch them off immediately. So they can actually be immense demand fluctuation tools on a grid. So example, here's the big issue in Africa. We have the duck curve issue. People in the morning use a lot of power. During the day, less power, then at night, a lot of power. So what's happened, example, in South Africa, Eskom, the government, allowed people to deploy solar power in their houses, businesses, etc. So what happened was the duck curve, the curve here in the middle, collapsed way down, which means the frequency of the grid is a big issue. Because in the morning, they have to give us power, but in the day, they lose about, I think, 3 to 4 gigawatts of demand. And then they need to throttle back up at night again to service that demand. Now, that duck curve is a big issue. It makes the grid unstable. They have to slow down the hydraulic engines. They have to turn down the turbines, and they have to boil them back up again. Lots of money, lots of maintenance. Now, what you do is you shove a Bitcoin mine into that duck curve. And then you know what happens? There's no curvature. So you keep the frequency, and the Bitcoin mines eat all that energy. And then when it needs the power, you release it again. So we have the, from a demand management perspective, Bitcoin mining is the ultimate thing to put on a grid. It stabilizes the grid. It enables renewable energy. So the big problem with renewable energy in South Africa at the moment, guess what? We have too much power. South Africa, we've got too much power. We've got wind, batteries, solar in the Northern Cape. In one town in South Africa, they generate, with the alternative and the renewables, 1.3 gigawatts of power. The town uses 50 to 60 megawatts. 50 to 60 megawatts. They're shedding in the ground almost a gig of power every day. They don't have the lines. So the grid congestion, they shove cables down into the ground and they shed that. So you know what we do? We put our Bitcoin mines on there and we unlock that congestion. And you know what? We generate money that pays for the transmission lines to get it to distribution. Across Africa, this is happening. People are deploying Bitcoin mines on hydroelectric instances because the source of power, you can put a couple of containers down, make money, tons of money. In Kenya, they're doing it right now. And in Sudan, the Chinese are doing it in Sudan. Kenya, they're doing it with Mara. Kenya declared in less than 9 months, they generated $200 million of income from the Bitcoin mines off their hydro power. But it wasn't just the money, it's the stabilization of the grid. Guess what? Another benefit, you put it in, you know what Bitcoin mines generate? Hot water and hot air to cool the ASICs. With hot water and hot air, you know what you can do from an agri-tech perspective for the community. So when you shut down a power station and you go to renewables, you put the Bitcoin mines, you attach it to all the infrastructure, that community, you give them agri-tech jobs. So you take that hot water and you shove it into an aquaponics farm. You put it through the soil. Suddenly you have tilapia fish. You've got greenhouses emerging. You take hot air, 70 to 80 degree hot air, you can do leather tanning, chili drying, biltong, all these things that you can do with the community. And then those skill sets that you can employ in the Bitcoin mine to manage the Bitcoin mines themselves. The circular economy that this thing generates is profound. More than 65% of all the Bitcoin mining energy used in the world is with renewables today. You know what it does? It sucks methane gas. Today, flaring of methane on dumps or when you're doing anything where there's mining, those methane emissions, big issue. So you know what they do? They flare the meat. They burn it. But the problem with flaring methane, you only burn about 30%. 70% is still let up into the atmosphere. So you know, instead of doing that, you connect the Bitcoin mine onto that flare. It sucks 100% of that methane, converts it into energy that mines Bitcoin. Your environmental impact goes down. You're making money.
This is all mind-blowing, isn't it? And
so what it means for Africa, it's a renaissance for us.
Mm.
It's an incredible opportunity.
You've been very strong on Bitcoin was made for us.
It's made for us. It wasn't made. It's made for us. Debasement, sovereignty, the ability to be a sovereign individual, to not have the government do something. You know, we're so worried what Cyril's going to do with Trump at the moment.
Interesting, we've got Beatrice here. The other thing I've seen is that it's going to be possible to fund NGOs, civil society, using Bitcoin because government won't be able to control stuff.
You know, when I walk around here, when I drive around in Zimbabwe and I look at your water, I look at that, the amount of energy you have here, the latent potential that lays in this country is profound. Profound. All you need to do is do it yourselves. Don't wait. Just do it. Government will embrace it when they see the benefits. And sometimes it requires people like myself with Trevor to engage with government and educate them and say it's not about you enabling it, it's you allowing it. Just get out the way.
Yeah.
There is no downside. There is no downside. There's no downside. I haven't seen the downside.
Right. Yeah. Let's end it there. I mean, it's what? It's past six or to six seven? Past six. Wow. Stafford.
Thank you.
This is why we wanted you to be here. Guys, don't you think he's amazing?
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You are a treasure to the continent, and I'm delighted that you've launched the Bitcoin Corporation, you've listed it, and you're doing... You know, the beauty about what we do on this platform is we get people that are actually doing stuff, not just talking about them. You're doing this stuff. You're living this stuff. You're investing in this stuff. You're putting your money at risk to make this stuff happen. So, Stafford, thank you so much. And for the fact that you landed this morning, had a meeting in Harare, you jumped onto a car, and you're here. That means a lot to all of us. So thank you so much.
Anytime.
Thank you. Thank you, brother.
Anytime, you know.
Thank you.